All right. I want to welcome everyone to the Accessibility Online webinar. My name is Claudia Diaz, and I'm with the Great Lakes ADA Center. This is a collaborative project of the ADA National Network and the U.S. Access Board. Today's session is on accessible schools. And this session is being broadcasted via the Illuminate platform in addition to the audio through the telephone. So if you wanted to listen through the telephone, the number is on the screen that you can dial. It is not a toll-free number, but the number is 712-732-3100. And the passcode is 930098. I wanted to address some of the features of the webinar platform. The closed captioning, as I mentioned, is available. The keystroke command for that is Control F8, or you can click on the CC icon from the toolbar. One thing I want to ask our participants is please refrain from using the emotion icons, the clapping, the happy face. That's very distracting to our presenters and to some of our participants, and we ask that you refrain from using those. We will be taking questions throughout this session in the chat area. They are locked or blocked for our participants, but please be aware that the moderator and the presenters will be receiving them at all times. So if you want to submit a question throughout the session, please do so in the chat area. I want to welcome our presenter, Earlene Sesker from the U.S. Access Board, and Peggy Greenwell. Peggy, you want to take it over?
Thanks, Claudia. And welcome to our session, our today's session on accessible schools. We appreciate everyone's participation, and it's my pleasure to introduce to you our presenter today. That is Earlene Sesker. Earlene is a graduate of the University of Texas, and she began her career at the Access Board in 1993. At that time, she was with the Office of Compliance and Enforcement, and she was managing accessibility cases brought under the Architectural Barriers Act. She currently serves as an accessibility specialist with the Office of Technical and Information Services, and among other responsibilities, she is part of the staff rulemaking team responsible for developing guidelines for medical diagnostic equipment. So, as you can imagine, with the topic of accessible schools, we have a lot of material to cover. Earlene, who is a frequent presenter, is someone who has the ability to get a lot of material or address a lot of material in a short amount of time. So at this point, just before I turn it over to Earlene, I did want to go back to Claudia was mentioning the question, the text box. We will not be able to address your questions until the end of the session. So while you could submit them, we will not be able to address them until after Earlene completes her presentation. So just wanted to make that clear. And at this point, I'll turn it over to Earlene.
Good afternoon, everyone. And again, I'd like to thank you for joining to listen to us today. As Peggy mentioned, I can usually cover quite a bit of information in a short period of time, but what that translates to is that sometimes I speak very fast. So feel free at any time to let us know that I'm going too fast and that I need to slow down. Or if you, by any chance, are just tired of hearing me and would like for me to speed up, you can do that also. Okay, today we're going to be talking about accessible schools. The agenda, as you see in front of you, I will be covering standards. We will let you know what standards are the applicable standards right now when you're looking at schools, what type of facilities are covered when we talk about schools, the scoping, how much of any of these particular items are required to be accessible. We're going to look at classrooms. We know that's a defining feature. Every school, no matter what type of school, is going to have a classroom. Then we have common use areas that are going to be found in the majority, if not all, of the schools in question. And then we are going to have an opportunity, we hope, to answer all of your questions. I want to use this period of time to just say that you were afforded the opportunity to ask questions prior to the session, and I have attempted to incorporate answers to those questions within the presentation today. So hopefully I will do that. Slide number 5. When we look at the standards, I'm sure you're all aware of, they, in September of 2010, the Department of Justice adopted a new standard. Basically, they adopted what the Access Board wrote in 2004 called the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Architecture Barriers Act Accessibility Guidelines. The Architecture Barriers Act is for accessibility of federal facilities. Now, the ADA, of course, is for the Department of Justice. The 2010 standard will become mandatory and enforceable on March 15th of 2012. In the time between September 2010 and the March 15th, 2012 deadline, the Department of Justice has given the permission to use either of the standards. So the 1991 standard, it still can be used until the March 15th deadline or on September 15th when the new standard was signed into law, you could at that point start to use that standard. It's important to note that what they don't want is for you to decide you're going to design this building, but I like what they tell me to do with bathrooms in the 2010, so I'll use that for the 2010, but I like a lower number of entrances in the 1991, so I'll use that. That is not allowed. You need to pick a standard, either use the 1991 for the entire facility or the 2010 for that entire facility. Now, when you have existing facilities, what comes into play for your Title II, which are your state and local government entities, a lot of your public school system, you have what's called program access. And that is going to deal with your existing facilities and deciding, under Title Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act, there is program access as well as under Title II. What that says is that all of your programs and services that are offered if you're a Title II facility need to be accessible. And so if you have an existing school, you're not doing any alterations to that existing school, you would still have the obligation to make your programs and services accessible. There are no waivers under the ADA. So if you have an existing facility, you can't say, well, my facility predated, and so I get a waiver. There's not a waiver. But when we talk about program access, it does not always mean a construction project. Sometimes it could be something as simple as offering that program or service someplace else, but sometimes it is going to be a construction project. When you have an existing school, we do realize that a lot of the things are not going to be up to the most recent standard. So as the need arises, basically there's someone that needs that access to that program or service, then you would be required to actually make upgrades to that, things that are readily achievable. As far as we did receive a question that talks about, that actually gives an example of a facility that has heavy doors at the front, has an elevator access, and the question was, would this be something that would be acceptable? For any questions on what really is considered acceptable under program access, you really should contact the Department of Justice, as well as for transition plans. We had a question about transition plans, and transition plans have been in effect since the beginning of the ADA in the early 1990s. At that time, all state and local government entities were required to create a transition plan, which basically would be looking at the deficiencies of your existing facilities and plotting out when and what you plan to do about those deficiencies. Now that plan needs to be revisited or in some cases a new plan made up with the new regulations, because of course we have new things that are added. We have recreational facilities. We have children's guidelines that were not in place before. Slide 6. When we look at the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Architecture Barriers Act standards, as I said, for the ADA, the Department of Justice is the enforcing agent. In 2010, they adopted what the Access Board wrote as the ADA-ABA guidelines in 2004. They adopted those to be the 2010 standard. In order for anything to be enforceable under the ADA, Titles 2 and 3, you would need the adoption of the Department of Justice and the Department of Transportation for transit facilities. In 2010, as I said, DOJ did their adoption, but in 2006, the Department of Transportation actually adopted it for transit facilities. Now, when you're looking at the Architecture Barriers Act, which, as I said earlier, means that federal buildings and facilities would need to be accessible, there are four standard-setting agencies. And those four standard-setting agencies would have to adopt the standard to make it enforceable. And those agencies, with the exception of one, have adopted the new standard. The General Services Administration, or GSA, adopted it in 2006. The Department of Defense adopted it in 2008. The United States Postal Service adopted in 2005. Right now, HUD, so if you'd be looking at anything that had HUD funding, any community block grants, anything that had HUD money, they are still using the Uniform Federal Accessibility Standard at this time. Slide 7. Covered facilities. We talk about schools. Everyone says, you say, well, this is for schools. Well, when we talk about that, we want you to know that we're talking about all schools. We're talking about as early as preschool on up through your elementary, your middle, your high school, college and universities, and your trade schools, which is why, as Peggy mentioned earlier, we're covering a lot of information because we know that you may have an element at a preschool that an element at a university that you're not necessarily going to have at a preschool. You may have swimming pools. You have your sporting facilities. So all of these things need to be looked at when we're looking at the school. What we say is covered when we talk about schools. Slide 8. New construction. When we're looking at new constructed facilities, one of the clarifications that we made in the new 2010 standard is that we wanted to make it clear that all areas are covered unless you see an exemption for it. There was always a problem where, well, you didn't specifically address my area or this facility that I'm talking about, so does that mean it's not covered? So we figured an easier way to do that is just to clarify that unless there is a specific exception or exemption for the facility or space or element that you're speaking of, then you know that it is covered. Now, there is a section that deals with just exempted structures and spaces. We have a section that has general exceptions, and it tells you those things that are generally not held to the requirements. Usually they're not held to the requirement. They're not required to be on an accessible route. Then we have work areas. The work area provisions aren't anything that are new for ADA facilities where we talk about the approach, enter, and exit. We did go a step further for larger facilities, for larger work areas. And then we're going to be looking at scoping, things that are partially scoped. And that is to say that you have numerous of these things or more than one of these things, and the ADA specifically does not require each one of them to be accessible. One of the things you'll find in the new standard, we have a new scoping for clustered toilet rooms, so that where in the previous standard 100% would be required to be accessible, now we would say if you have them clustered together, only 50%. So that's an example of what we could call something that's partially scoped. Slide 9. Parking. Now we're going to look at parking. Well, we're going to look at scoping. And when I spoke of scoping earlier, I told you we're going to be talking about things that are required to be accessible and telling you the scoping tells you how many of those things. The way we've broken this presentation down today is first we'll talk to you about the scoping, and then we'll talk to you about the technical guidelines for those elements that have been scoped. What you're going to find is that in some instances, we are kind of combining the two just because once you start talking about the scoping, it's easier to branch off into the technical. But for the most part, you're going to find them separated. And when we look at scoping, we're going to be looking at your parking, telling you how many parking spaces are required to be accessible, your entrances to your facilities, your accessible routes, that would be throughout the site and throughout the building, your classroom requirements, toilet and bathing areas, and things that are common use, as well as public spaces that are not listed on there. Slide 10. When we look at the scoping for accessible parking, it's important to know that when we talk about parking, we're talking about all types of lots that you may have, whether that be visitor, patron, or employee parking. This does not exclude if you have lots where you have spaces assigned to someone. Even if you have assigned spaces, they are required to have the appropriate number of accessible spaces. And the amount of accessible spaces required, the number of accessible spaces, is calculated on a facility-by-facility basis. And when we talk about a facility, it could be something as small as a lot that has one space to a big standalone parking structure. Now, there are some exceptions within the new guideline, and one would be that if you have a bus lot, So if you have your school bus lot where you keep all the buses, and it is a public space, the public would access the space. But if this is a bus lot, even though it's public access space, you're not required to have accessible spaces as long as you have an accessible passenger loading zone for that lot. Then another exception, which I don't know how many you're going to find, a very small lot at schools, but if for any reason you have a very small lot that has four or fewer spaces, we do exempt you from the requirement for identification for those spaces. Slide 11. When determining, when I said you'd already, you have to look at a facility by facility basis, and we do have this chart within the 2010 standards, very similar to what was in the 1991 standard that would tell you, and what you look at is based on how many parking spaces are in that total lot or facility, it tells you how many of those spaces are required to be accessible. In determining this, it's important to say that although the calculation should be lot by lot, the spaces can be located in one lot. Say if you have two different lots, but one lot is closer to the facility, maybe one lot is covered from the weather, anything that would afford greater accessibility. So if you have the two lots, but one lot is more accessible for whatever reason, you can have all of your accessible spaces in the more accessible lot. But you would still have to have the number that would be required. So you would look at the lots separately, calculate how many spaces would need to be in each lot, and then that total number of spaces can be moved into one location. Slide 12. When you deal with passenger loading zones, I'd already said there is an exception for your bus parking lot. But now we have school situations, and what we've done with the 2010 standard is we've changed the requirement when we talk about passenger loading zones. In the 1991 standard, you were specifically told that you had to have at least one passenger loading zone. But we've noticed that we needed to address facilities like schools that have long, continuous areas for passenger loading or airports. So what we've done now is connected it to the actual length. So we're saying at least one for every 100 linear feet of loading space needs to be provided. Now this is photo that you're looking at. We looked at this quite a bit, and we're trying to determine, and in looking at this, although we're showing it here, we're talking about accessible passenger loading zones, it appears that it is accessible as far as the actual length. You have enough space there for the parking of the vehicle. It meets the vertical clearance requirements that are there, but it doesn't appear to meet the new requirement that says that that passenger loading zone must be on the same level as the actual parking space. Slide 13. Okay, now we get into the scoping for classrooms. Classrooms are considered assembly areas. So when you look for your specifications for classrooms, you're not going to see a separate scoping that specifically says classrooms. What you're going to see is assembly areas. You get there from your classrooms. We do have a definition within the 2010 standard of assembly areas, and classrooms and lecture halls are specifically mentioned in that definition. So when you're looking at the specifications for classrooms, what you would do is you would be looking to your assembly areas. Now our specifications in the 2010 standard are tied to fixed seats, okay? But that's not to say that if you have a classroom that has furniture that you're not required to have the accessible spaces within that. DOJ is currently undertaking a rulemaking or looking at undertaking a rulemaking where they're going to actually be addressing furniture. But in lieu of that, and in the meantime, you do still have, which I talked about at length earlier, your program access requirements. Your class is a program that you're offering there, so you do need to make that accessible. So although the guidelines are tied to fixed, there would still be requirements to ensure that even if you have tables or something, that the students have access to those programs and services. Slide 14. Now we'll move on to toilet rooms. Toilet rooms, when you get to situations where you have a preschool situation, you may have toilet rooms that are within the actual classroom. Toilet rooms, even if they are within the classrooms, are required to be accessible. Slide 15. Now, when we talk about the cluster, what we've decided, or what we've added with the new guidelines, and this was to be responsive to places like doctor's offices or places where you have multiple single-user toilet rooms located in one area. We previously, in the 91 standard, would have said that every one of those, 100% of those, is required to be accessible. In the new 2010 standard, there's an exception. And what that exception says is that if you have multiple single-user restrooms clustered at one location that serve the same users, instead of 100%, you're only required to have 50%. Now, when we talk about cluster, we're talking about group of toilet rooms within sight or adjacent to one another. We did have a question about clustered classrooms, and this would be something similar to what I showed on the previous slide with, say, a preschool class. And the question was addressing the fact that each of these classrooms has their own toilet room. So would that meet the cluster? In a situation like that that you're looking at, the classrooms are clustered, but the toilet rooms are not. The toilet rooms are not adjacent to each other. They are not seen within, you're not standing and looking at all of them at once. They're within classrooms. So they would not get the 50% cluster. The classrooms are clustered, not the toilet rooms. And additionally, I just want to mention that when you're figuring your 50%, if you come up with a fraction, then you are to round up. For example, if you have five clustered and your 50% gets you 2.5, then you'd be required to have 3 accessible. Slide 16. Now we're talking about common use areas. When people talk about common use areas, they think about things like bathrooms and your standard things. But when you're looking at common use, I mean, you have your gyms as shown there, your cafeterias, teachers' lounges. Because when we look at common use areas, we're even saying that these are things that can be restricted to a group of occupants. So we'd be looking at things like teachers' lounges also, and even laboratories. Now, it's important to say that a laboratory or research laboratory at a university, at a high school, they are considered common use spaces. Some are considered classrooms, they're research laboratories. But when we talk about them being common use spaces and we say that they're required to be accessible because all common use spaces are required to be accessible, that is the actual access to that classroom. When we go further into what would be required for laboratory stations and so forth, the requirement only says 5% of those are to be accessible. But the room itself, as far as getting in and out of that room, it is required to be fully accessible. Slide 17. When we look at, we'll be also looking at your public use areas. And when we talk about public use areas, this could be your school office or any other waiting area within. I know some schools have other types of facilities. You have your health room. You have some schools are affiliated, universities are affiliated with hospitals. So you would have your office or your waiting area. And it's important to note that when you're looking at public use areas such as offices, they can also be common use as well as employee work areas. So you would be looking at a compilation of all of the requirements for those areas when you're looking at some public use areas. Slide 18. Public use and common use toilet rooms. We've already talked about there's the new cluster exception, but there's also, and this isn't any different, there's always been a requirement or an allowance that says that if you have a single user restroom that's only accessed by one person in someone's office, that can be adaptable. I mean, we have gone further to specify within the technical requirements what we consider to be adaptable. But remember, when we talk about what can be adaptable, it has to be a single occupant. So we're talking about a single user restroom that's in the office for a single occupant. This restroom or toilet room needs to be accessed through that private office and is limited to the use of just the occupant of that private office. Say if you have a university president and they have their own toilet room within their office. Now, that's not to say that that restroom should be used by the president as well as the president's staff. This would be only for the use of that one single occupant of that office. Then you're allowed to make that toilet room adaptable. And when you look at adaptable, you're not really exempted from any of the size requirements, just some of the height requirements, some of the actual putting grab bars up. You would be allowed to just do the enforcement and different things like that that are within in the technical requirements. Slide 19. Work areas. As I mentioned earlier, when we talk about work areas in the 91 standard as well as in the standard, we have requirement that says that for an employee work area, the employee should be able to approach, enter, and exit that area. So when we talk about approaching that area, of course, we're talking about there should be an accessible route leading to that area. Enter would mean that the doorway should meet all of the door requirements, and then there should be clear floor space at the door to meet the requirements as well as the hardware and so forth to actually get into that door. Now, we go further to say that we, on the slide, that we do recommend that whenever possible that you have interior door maneuvering clearance as well as turning space. This is not required for a work area. If this were a common use space, as well as a work area, then it would be required to be fully accessible. It would be required to have that interior door maneuvering clearance and to have that turning space. I also want to mention here, if you're talking about a facility that falls under the Architecture Barriers Act, maybe you have a military school, they do not get the approach, enter, and exit. Those areas, if it falls under the Architecture Barriers Act, are required to be fully accessible. Now, we did have a question where someone was wondering about a laboratory that possibly has doors in a series, and you're looking at the approach, enter, and exit. If this is a work area only, and we're talking approach, enter, and exit, they would not be entered into that work area until they access both doors. So that door would, or those doors would have to meet all of the requirements for doors in a series. Now, one of the reasons when we look at the work area and approach, enter, and exit, under Title III, that's all that's required. That's not to say that's all that's required under the ADA, because then you have Title I. And under Title I, it says when and if an employee is hired that has a disability, then the employer is required to make accommodations necessary for that employee to actually do their job. And this would be accessing that actual facility. And one of the reasons for this is that if under Title III we mandated, well, these are the requirements that you need to meet to make this workspace fully accessible, we could be making you follow requirements that are for a person that uses a wheelchair. Maybe the person that is hired for that office isn't a person that uses a wheelchair. They could be a person of shorter stature. So Title I does allow you to actually provide full access for that particular employee's individual needs. Slide 20. When we look at accessible routes, we are going to be talking about accessible routes within the site as well as accessible routes within the facility. Now, when we're looking at the site, there's a requirement that you have accessible routes connecting from the boundary of the site to bus stops, accessible parking, passenger loading zones and entrances, all of your accessible elements on that site. Now, it is recognized that you may have a bus stop that's close by, but that it's not on the boundary of the site. The requirement that we're speaking of for the accessible route would get you to the boundary of the site. We're not requiring that someone provide an accessible route on property that is not theirs. So your responsibility for your accessible route would only be to the boundary of your site. Slide 21. When we look at entrances, another change that you will see from the 1991 standard, the 1991 standard required 50% of the public entrances to be accessible. What the 2010 standard requires is that at least 60% of your public entrances comply. Okay? But now, in addition to that, we have these other entrances that may not necessarily be public entrances. And what we're looking at is if you have parking structure, all of your direct access points from that parking structure are required to be accessible, as well as if you have direct access from tunnels or elevated walkways. At least one from each tunnel or each elevated walkway is required to be accessible. As the same goes for your tenant spaces, you should have at least one accessible route from each of your tenant spaces, to and from each of your tenant spaces. And then if you have restricted or secured entrances, at least one of those restricted or secured entrances should be accessible. Slide 22. When we look at your accessible routes leading to your accessible entrances, if at all, the goal here is to have the accessible route be the same route that's used by your general public. And it should be, if though, for some reason, and I'm sure you'll find that probably more when you're dealing with existing, and you're going to find a lot of existing schools, that maybe the accessible route can't be. Maybe this is an older school. Maybe you have steps as in the drawing. And so maybe it can't be exactly the same route, but then what we would say is that it should be in the same general area. If it cannot be the exact same route, then it should be in the same general area. Slide 23. When you talk about your interior accessible route, we've gotten you from the boundary of the site, from your bus stops, from your parking. Now we're going to get you to the entrance of that facility, and then you should have at least one accessible route that is going to connect that accessible entrance with all of your accessible elements and spaces within that facility. So what you're seeing there with your highlighted area is you're coming in that accessible entrance, and then all of those highlighted spaces are accessible, required accessible elements. And so if they're required to be accessible, they are accessible, there needs to be an accessible route leading you to those spaces. Slide 24. Same drawing, a little different highlight. What we're showing you here is along that accessible route. Of course, what good would it do you to have your accessible route leading to your spaces? Then when you get to the door, you cannot access that. So part of that accessible route getting you into those spaces, of course, would be your door accessibility. And for all of those spaces and rooms, you're required to have at least one accessible entrance that is going to get you into that space. And of course, you're required to have accessible doors also along your means, your accessible routes for your means of egress. Slide 25. Now we talk about vertical access. We're talking about elevators here. People, when I just start with vertical access, what is she really talking about? One of the things that we've clarified in this, because there were exceptions, and some of the exceptions are still the same with our elevators, and one of the ones that I think most people know is that we say that if a facility is less than 3 stories or less than 3,000 square feet, you're not required to have an elevator. Now we're saying you're not required to have vertical access, but what we've clarified in this is that if you qualify for any of the elevator exemptions or exceptions, you're not required to have any other type of vertical access. So we're not saying, well, you don't have to have an elevator, but yeah, you still have to do something. You have to do a lift. You have to do a ramp. What we're saying is that if you qualify for any of the exceptions that are there for elevators, that you are not required to provide any type of vertical access. Now, when you're dealing with these two entities that you see noted on the slide, your Title II entities, state and local government, or healthcare providers, or a third one actually was even shopping centers. We didn't put shopping centers. We are assuming most of your schools and universities haven't branched that far yet that they have shopping centers. But some are affiliated with healthcare providers, hospitals. As I said, I've seen universities that have their own hospitals or affiliated with hospital systems. These entities have never before gotten the vertical access or vertical access exemption. But in the 2010 standard, there is a new exception that we're talking about with state and local government entities, and it says that now for the first time for Title II entities, if you have a 2-story public building or facility that has an occupant load of 5 or less, and it does not contain public space on that upper level, then you're not required to have vertical access to that space. Slide 26. Something else new is what we've done in this is in the 1991 standard, we had our accessible means of egress. We told you what we consider accessible means of egress. We talked about areas of rescue assistance and so forth. What we're doing now in the 2010 standard is leaving all of that to IBC. So we're now referring. We're referencing the IBC standard for the accessible means of egress. The one thing that I do want to note here is that when you look at the IBC code for the egress, they do allow the use of a platform lift as part of the egress route. So what we wanted to ensure is that if you have an emergency and egress and power is shut down, that platform lift would still be accessible. So what the ADA standards is requiring that is that if you use that platform lift as part of your egress route, it has to have standby power. slide 27. Well, next we're talking about telephones, public telephones. Not sure how many facilities still have them. Everybody pulls out the handy-dandy cell phone now, and not as many people are using public telephones. And I think they probably don't take the students' cell phones away from them if they bring them to school. I think they're still doing that. I don't know anymore. But if by some instance we have a relic of a school or something that still has public telephones, we would still be looking at that, and we do still have scoping for those. Now when we talk about, there may be courtesy phones, you might still find those or your closed circuit, but what we're talking about with those is for you should have one phone for every floor, every bank per floor level, or even if it's on an exterior site. Now if you have two or more, So with the first one, you could have multiple banks on that floor, but only one would be required to have that accessible phone. But if you had two or more, then it's one per bank. Okay? Slide 28. Dressing, fitting, and locker rooms. What you'll note, the difference, the biggest difference here from the 1991 standard is the 1991 standard only spoke to dressing and fitting rooms. Now with the addition of the recreational facilities into the 2010 standard, we are looking also at locker rooms. And what we're saying with that is that you should have access to 5% of each type of use in each cluster. So if you have different types of lockers, maybe you have smaller lockers, shorter lockers, lockers that are specified for a certain, maybe for swimming, there's different types of lockers, then 5% of each type in each cluster are required to be accessible. And we do give more specifics in the technical where we talk about your coat hooks and your shelves, but we also say in the scoping for those that at least one, so if you have coat hooks or shelves that are provided that in dressing or fitting in locker rooms that without individual compartments, at least one of each type is required to comply. Slide 29. Now we're going to go way out to something that we know was nowhere near in the 1991 standard, but we know schools all have play areas. Well, maybe not universities, but when you're looking at your elementary and your preschool, we're going to be looking at play areas. And so one of the big things, and you all have probably been looking at this for a while, because these have been out as far as the Access Board is concerned for a while. They haven't been enforceable, but we've had them, and we've been telling people for a while now that they can use them for guidance. Okay, and so what we're looking at is ground level requirements. So if you have that play area and you have ground level play components, so that's to say you don't have that big composite structure, you have the individuals as shown on the slide, individual pieces of play equipment. What the requirement says is that one of each type of ground level. If there's only one of that type of component, then it must be accessible. If there's more than one of a particular type, then at least one must be accessible. We did have a question about existing facilities and what their requirements would be for an existing playground. It's, as I've spoken over and over, we'd be looking at program access. And so you'd be looking at making that is a program or a service that's provided by that school. It's part of the daily program for the students. So you would have a responsibility to provide access to the programs and services. And the regulations that are now going to be in place in the 2010 standard, the requirements, can be used as guidance in trying to provide that. Of course, if this were new construction, you definitely would need to meet the requirements to the letter of what's being required. But when you're dealing with the program access, you'd be looking at what's considered readily achievable. But it's important to say when you're making these programs and services accessible and you're looking at what's readily achievable, that doesn't mean I can't meet this requirement, so I don't have to meet any of them. If one can't be met, that doesn't eliminate the need for the others. You would still have to look at the other requirements and meet those requirements. But again, that would be your program access. Slide 30. Then now we're going to talk about the actual composite structures. The last slide we were looking at your individual play pieces and we were talking about your ground level. Now we're looking at play structures that have elevated play structures that have components. Okay, and when we're looking at that, we're saying that, and this is broken down actually into the size of that actual play structure. And what we're saying is 50% of all elevated pay components in a play area must be reached by an accessible route. But then when we go further with that, we're looking at your smaller play structure. And if you have a smaller play structure that has less than 20 elevated components, then we're saying that 50% that needs to be accessible can be accessed via ramp or a transfer system. But on the other hand, if you have a very large play structure that has 20 or more elevated components, when you look at that 50%, we're saying at least 25% of that 50% requirement must be ramp access. The other 25, your discretion. It can be either ramp or transfer, but 25 of that 50% must be ramp. Slide 31. Now we're looking at areas of sport activity. And when you look at this drawing, what we're seeing there is a sport complex. You see all of the yellow arrows, and they're highlighting different sporting areas, different areas of sports activity on this in the sporting complex that would be required to be accessible and be on an accessible route. And when we talk about area of sport activity, we're talking about the area that the sport is actually being played. And what the standards require is that there be an accessible route to each of those areas of sport activity. But now when you get into that sport itself, we're not actually requiring anything that's going to change the play of that sport. So what we're doing with those areas of sport activity is they have been exempted from the requirements for firm, stable, and slip resistant on the actual surface, not the route leading to, but the actual surface of the area of sport activity. Slide 32. Exercise equipment. Probably won't see this in your elementary and preschools, but I'm sure some of the universities have exercise equipment. They have workout rooms. The athletes have to keep in shape. When you're dealing with your exercise equipment and your machines, what the requirements say is one of each type is required to be accessible. And when we talk about them being required to be accessible, well, I'm getting ahead of myself because we're going to be looking at the actual technical later. But this is just telling you that one of each type. And then I'll tell you what we mean by one of each type a little bit later when we get into the actual technical requirements. Slide 33. You'll find just a sidebar here that sometimes I do get ahead of myself and I try to catch myself though and pull myself back in. But the worst that can happen here is when I get ahead of myself, I just may end up telling you the same thing twice. And that won't hurt. You'll remember it because Earlene just kept saying it over and over and over. Now when we deal with swimming pools, as I said, you may not find a swimming pool at an elementary school. You may, if there's a special school. My daughter went to a special school for years, and they did have a swimming pool. But a lot of universities, you have swim teams, there's swimming pools. So we have the requirements now for swimming pools. And what we're looking at, I mean, there's always been a requirement. That's not to say that swimming pools weren't required to be accessible. There were just not specifics to address how to get someone into the pool until this 2010 standard. What we had were requirements that told you there needed to be an accessible route to get you to the pool. Now we're looking at getting you in the pool. And again, this is something that we're breaking down where we're looking at size. And what we're saying is that if you have a pool that has a pool wall over 300 linear feet, okay, then you're required to have two means of access. And one of those means must be a lift or sloped entry. Okay. Then if you have a smaller pool that has less than 300 linear feet of pool wall, then you're required to have either a lift or slope entry. You're only required to have one entry. It can be either of those two. Slide 34. This is to tell you that now we're coming into the technical requirements. I may have already given you some technical, but the bonus is you'll get to hear it again now. Slide 35. Passenger loading zones. This would only anybody that's just doing a school, I mean, I've seen schools where you have the canopy over the passenger loading zone. It's never been a requirement for schools. The only place that this was ever a requirement was when you were dealing with medical care facilities. It has been now removed from the 2010 standard. So if you are one of those universities that has a hospital affiliated with it, that in the past there was a requirement for a canopy, that requirement has been removed from the 2010 standard. Basically, because one of the reasons why we looked looked at that, removing that, and it was removed. This is the only place that it was required. So that was to say that other entrances where people with disabilities were having to enter did not need a canopy, but we were saying just that a hospital would. And then there was a debate as to whether this was really an accessibility issue or a comfortability issue. So that has been taken out of the 2010 standard. Slide 36. Accessible entrances, automatic doors. Everyone wants automatic doors on their facilities, and we still, you wouldn't believe, even after all of these years when it's never been required for automatic doors, we still get calls where people are saying this facility is not accessible because it doesn't have automatic doors. Well, automatic doors are still not a requirement. We do recommend them whenever possible. Now, if this were a facility that was under the Architectural Barriers Act and the General Services Administration, they have written their own policy where on their facilities they are requiring automatic door openers. The ADA standard is still not requiring automatic door openers, and the requirement for the actual opening force for the door is still not mandated for exterior doors. We still have the same problem, and the problem being that what we would have to actually mandate for an accessible door opening force would not, what the building codes have to use for a closing force would not be an accessible resistance. It would be too heavy. And when they're looking at what's calculated in a closing force, they have to calculate the door weight, the wind, the air pressure, HVAC systems. And when you're dealing with things like wind, that's different all over the United States depending on the weather conditions. So if we give you a pounds of force that may work in a place with light winds, it may not necessarily work in a place that is used to strong winds. So at this point in time, there still is not a mandate for door opening pressure for exterior doors. Slide 37. Protruding objects. In school hallways, we always see that lone water fountain or drinking fountain sitting there that, in essence, is a protruding object. But one of the things that we need to note is, yes, these are your glaring protruding objects. But when we talk about protruding objects, we're not just talking about things along the accessible route. We're talking about anything that's in a circulation path that's protruding more than 4 inches, anywhere at a height of 27 inches to 80 inches. It is considered a protruding object. When manufacturers try to sell you these drinking fountains, and we'll get calls from people, and they're saying, well, they told me this drinking fountain was accessible, but now we're being told it's not accessible, it protrudes more than 4. Placement, a lot of times, can determine accessibility, and that's not just with your drinking fountains. It could be with your paper towel dispensers in your bathroom, anything that protrudes. It's all of where it's placed, and as you can see with these two photos, the one on the right, that drinking fountain is just on a wall along your accessible route. And we have many people that think, too, when you're dealing with that high-low, they say, well, the low one on the other side. But we can't actually regulate how someone's going to be, what side of that hall they're going to be walking on. So it may not be a protruding object from one side where it may be on the other. But if you look at the photo on your left, it shows you a way to fix that. We could have taken those same drinking fountains that are in the right and just put them in an alcove like the one is done on the right drawing, and you have that same fountain that no longer is an is a protruding object. Slide 38. Now we're going to move into our toilet rooms, classrooms, public use, and common use areas. As I said, we're moving into this. It's going to be technical. I will probably be mentioning some of the scoping within this too, but for the most part, what we're going to be looking at now are the technical specifications for your toilet rooms, classrooms, public use, and your common use areas. Slide 39. Water closets. A big change that we made, anyone that's familiar with the 1991 standard, we had figure 28 where we would show you all the different approaches to your water closet. And when you looked at those, what you saw was that within 18 inches from the center line of the toilet, you would see the lath. And that was allowed in those drawings. To be perfectly honest with you, I always thought it was a mistake and that somebody just missed it. But at any rate, if it was a mistake, it's now been corrected in the 2010 standard. Because as you can see, with a lab that close to the water closet, that would prevent anyone from making a parallel transfer onto that water closet. It also did pose problems in many instances for that rear grab bar that was required. Because with the 36 inches that would be required there, in some instances, instances, if the lab was put so close, then the grab bar was actually overlapping. Or even with the lab that close, you might find an instance where someone decides to use the lab to lean on to transfer versus the grab bar, which the lab is not made for supporting the person. So you then would have your safety issues. So what we did in the 2010 standard is we revised things. So this configuration is no longer allowed. Slide 40. What you'll be looking at now in the new standard is like the drawing, and what you'll see too is we changed all of our drawings because we realized a lot of them weren't as clear as we thought they were, I think, in the beginning. But we've streamlined that. Everything should look a lot better. And what you're going to see now is that nothing is allowed within that water closet clearance that's required there. The clear floor spaces can overlap, but the fixture itself, no fixture can be situated in the clear floor space for another fixture. And what you'll find we have 18. Another thing that you'll find is what we tried to do in the new guidelines is to get away from absolute dimensions. Because what you find is when you're trying to do, say, the absolute dimension for the center line from the toilet to the closest wall, in the 1991 standard was 18 inches. Then when you were designing that, you forgot that the tile that you were going to put on the wall was a half an inch thick, and now you're no longer at 18 inches. Now you're at 18 and a half. So what we've tried to do in fixing problems like that is to put in ranges and get away from the absolute dimensions. So what you'll find now is for that center line of that toilet from the wall to from the closest wall to the toilet, we've now given a range of 16 to 18. And that's what you'll find throughout the document where we've tried to go to ranges and get rid of the absolute dimensions. Slide 41. Toilet rooms, another thing that you'll find, and we used to receive a lot of questions on this, and that is because there is a provision in the 1991 standard that says that the door cannot swing into the clear floor space that's required for the use of any of the fixtures. Then we would receive phone calls, people saying, but this is a single-user toilet room. No one else is going to be coming in here when someone's using it, so why does it matter if the door swings into the clear floor space? I would be the one opening the door. Very valid point, but in 20 years later, now updating the guidelines, we do have instances, well, yes, even with a single user, you may have someone that has an attendant that may need to come in that bathroom, may not need to be in there at the beginning, but may need to come in there at some time. So what we've tried to do to take care of both of those issues is to say that the door can swing into the fixture clearances as long as there is an unobstructed wheelchair space that is available within that room that is beyond the swing of the door. Slide 42. The rear grab bar, the drawing in the 1991 diagram was a problem. We were trying to show the positioning of that rear grab bar. And so when we're looking at the 24, we're looking at the 12, we would get many questions where people were thinking somehow, because I believe in one of the drawings we would show 12 on one side because we were saying that it could be hanging over 12 inches on either side from the center line. But what was happening is people were getting out of that what we were requiring is a 24 or allowing was a 24-inch grab bar. Not true. The rear grab bar has to be 36 inches minimum. It can be longer, which is why when we say 12 on that side, minimum, 24 minimum. If you have a longer grab bar, those minimums increase. But the rear grab bar is most usable on the open side. So that's where we would want the greatest amount of that grab bar. The grab bar should be 36 inches minimum. From the center line of the water closet, it should extend 24 inches minimum on the open side and 12 inches on the other side. This is where we're talking about your standard configuration for a water closet in a single-user toilet room or actually in a stall. Slide 43. Something else new that we've added in the 2010 standard is what we tried to show is different designs for your standard single-user restroom. We looked at the other water closet. We talked about how the fixtures cannot overlap the clear floor space for another fixture. Well, what we've thrown in here is, and after I just finished stressing to you about the 36-inch grab bar, that if you're using this design, if your space allows, maybe you have a smaller space, so you can't stretch things out as much. But if it allows you to recess that lav so that, as you can see from that drawing, the lav is not actually in the clear floor space for the use of the water closet. The clear floor space is overlapped, but the lab is not there. So if you're using this type of configuration, and because of the placement of the lab, there is not enough space for the 36-inch grab bar, then you are allowed, in this instance only, to do the 24-inch minimum rear grab bar. Slide 44. Okay, another question that we've been getting a lot of, another area we've been getting a lot of questions on is the vertical grab bar. ANSI requires a vertical grab bar. It is not an ADA standard requirement. It is an ANSI requirement that there be that grab bar. What you will see, and I'll be going into it, should have put my slides in a little better order here, but what you will hear me talking about is in the 2010 standard, we do have a requirement now for the first time where we're talking about how close something can be mounted above a grab bar. This vertical grab bar that's being required by ANSI is in that space that we were ordinarily saying now in the new standards cannot be encroached upon. But in order to allow for this, or what helps this be able to mount it, is that we do have an exception there that we say the space between the grab bars and other grab bars can be permitted to be as small as 1.5 inch. That's the minimum, 1.5 inch. So that does allow it to be placed there. Slide 45. The flush control, no change as far as the placement. It should still be on the open side of the water closet. The only change that we made is in the 91 standard. It said 44 inches. Now we're taking it to 48 just to actually harmonize everything, because there would be no rational reason why you would need a reaching height of 48 every place else is an accessible height, but then when you get here, it would be 44. So we're just trying to make everything the same, so that's now within the reach range of a maximum height of 48. Slide 46. I just mentioned with the grab bar and the placement, we've received a lot of questions where people are wondering how close can something be to the grab bar before it stops the grab bar from being usable. So in the new standards, what you see is that we say that 12 inches, nothing should be mounted within 12 inches, of course, unless it's a grab bar shower fitting, unless you're eligible for that exception where we talk about the things that can be placed. Nothing else can be placed within 12 inches above the grab bar or 1.5 inch below the grab bar. Slide 47. One of the problems that you'll find with what we just talked about with placing above are these large dispensers that everyone or people used to. I don't see them as much anymore. But if you have a large dispenser like this and you're trying to place it above, it would have to be 12 above, and then are you then going to be out of your reach range at your height of 48? So with something like this, if they're still being used, you may have to look at putting it below, but then you would also have to look at the minimum of the reach range and be sure that the outlet is still within that minimum, no lower than that minimum range for the reach range. Slide 48. In looking at 48, no change. Your standard stall dimensions remain the same. 56-inch minimum for the wall hung for your width. 59 for the floor mounted. The only change is that we now have the children's, and the children dimension is the same as that for the floor mounted. Slide 49. Along with your standard stall, of course, if you have a multi-user restroom and you have the stalls, there's a requirement that one of the stalls be fully accessible, your standard stall. But then if you have a larger restroom or larger toilet room that has six or more stalls, then in addition to your standard stall, you're required to have your what we call your ambulatory stall, which has your two grab bars, because we're talking about people that may be using crutches or canes. So you have your parallel grab bars on opposing walls. And with this for the first time, we are actually specifying a depth. We've never specified a depth, and we did have a set dimension for the width, and now we're giving a range for that. And the door must be outswinging and self-closing for that type of a stall. Slide 50. And we're moving on to lavatories. The important things to know, I mean, with lavatories, nothing's really changed except we did do away with the apron. There was always an apron clearance for 29. In addition, we had the knee clearance for 27. Done away with the apron clearance. Thing to note here is, and I do realize that some states require an accessible lab within the accessible stall. The new 2010 standards have provisions that now say that if you have more than one fixture in that stall now has to be treated as a single user toilet room with all of the size requirements. requirements, and so that could be accessible, but you would still need your lab on the outside that would be accessible also. So basically what you would end up treating them like were two single-user restrooms, one within the other. Slide 51. This is a no-no. Many people, you find this in hospital. It's a hospital style, but people, when you hear accessible, for some reason think that it needs to be shaped different or to allow space to slide under, but we do discourage the use of this type of a hospital, this type of a lab. It's deep. It makes it hard for you to actually be able to, from your clear floor space, reach your controls and get your knee clearance under there. So we do discourage the use of that. We did have a question where someone was wondering about in a special class. They said they have a laundry sink in a special class. Now, if this is a laundry sink, there are exceptions that talk about service and mop sinks. But when we're talking about service and mop sinks, we're looking at sinks that are used for employee use. When you're dealing with a sink that's used by both teachers and students as part of the student's learning, we now are putting this as your classroom, your common use, your public use, so that sink would be required to be accessible. If this is something that would only be used by the teachers, then you could look at it as a part of the employee work area and say under Title I, when and if you hire an employee that had that disability, you'd have to make it accessible. But if it's being used by the teachers and the students alike, it is required to be accessible. Slide 52, children's guidelines. Again, as with the play areas, you've been seeing the children guidelines around for a while. We've been referring people to them for guidance. Important to know that here they're alternate specifications. We're never saying you have to use these. What we say that is if you're designing a water closet or toilet room and it's for children's use, then you have the option of using these guidelines. But now if you decide not to use these, then you're reverted back to using those that are specified for the adult. You can't make up something in between. It's either you're designing and using to the letter of the law for your standard toilet specifications, or if you're designing for children, you can use these. What you'll find is that we give you range here. Now, on slide 53, what we do is further break down that range. In the actual technical specifications, you'll see the range that's going to deal with the water closet center line, your toilet seat height, and your dispenser height. What you won't see in the actual technical language is your grab bar height. That is something that's purely an advisory. Now, your advisory for the other things that I'm speaking of that have technical guidance, you would still need to look at your advisory if you wanted to design for a specific age group. But when you're dealing with a grab bar height, that is only in the advisory. We've had a couple of questions about that because when you're dealing with the lowered grab bar, if you're putting your flush valves at your standard height, then you're looking at a conflict between the bar and the flush valve, and in many instances, plumbing codes are allowing people to break them and so forth. But I think it's important, and one of the things that may help with this conflict is that to not just use pieces of the children's. If you're going, first of all, let me start out by saying the grab bar height is an advisory. So it's when you look at the actual technical specs, it actually sends you to the regular grab bar height, but because it's an advisory, it can be used as part of equivalent facilitation. But then be sure to use all of the children's specifications, because if you don't, if you use bits and pieces, then you could have some type of conflict because there is a lower flush valve requirement also when you're dealing with the children. So it's giving a maximum height of 36. And so if you're doing a maximum height of 36, that means that can be lower and can be lower than what the grab bar height specifications advise. Slide 54. Children's lavatories. What we did with the children's lavatories, they don't have a full section like they do in the actual toilet rooms, but it's still basically two exceptions. And what we're looking at is broken down if you're looking at age group from 6 to 12, then we're allowing a lower knee clearance as well as a lower lav height. So we're looking at a maximum of 31 inch lav height, and if you do that maximum, then you're allowed to have a knee clearance of the 24 inch minimum. And then if you have ages 5 and under, we're allowing that you don't have to have that forward approach at all. It can just be a side approach. Slide 55. showers. Okay, when you're looking at showers, what we did is we clarified showers. None of the dimensions really changed. We changed our drawings to show where that 36 inches measured from. It's not measured from that outer wall, to show that we're looking at the actual interior of that. We actually show that you can use spit grab bars. It can be continuous. It can be split. And we clarified that the seat can be folding or non-folding. Slide 56. For your transfer shower, your positioning, your clear floor space, it's 48 by 36. What is important to know, okay, the shower itself we know is 36 by 36. In front of that, that space should be 36 by 48. But that extra 12 that we're talking about, the shower is 36, then we have that 48 space, that extra 12 inches should be on the side of the shower where the seat is positioned. And that is because that is to be used so that a person would be able to position their chair and actually transfer directly onto the bench. So be sure that that clear floor space is aligned with the seat wall. Slide 57. We clarified with this. What we did is that we wanted to be sure that the controls were 15-inch max from the outside, from the opening, to allow someone to actually be able to use the controls before entering the actual shower stall. If you want to be able to control, you want to get in there and then turn the hot water on you, all of that can be taken care of. So the controls had to be where they would be reachable. And so it was decided that 15 inches maximum would make them usable from the outside of the stall. And we have a maximum of 1/2 inch curb now on the transfer shower. Slide 58. When we look at your roll-in shower, we clarify, one of the things we clarify with that is the placement of the lav. And basically, that if you have a shower, a roll-in shower, and the lav can be placed in that clear floor space that's available there as long as it's on the opposite wall of where a seat is positioned, if there's a seat in there, or from the controls. Now, if there is no seat, the controls can then be put on any wall. So then you can place that. It's not as critical that it be placed opposite that, because the controls can then be placed on any of the wall. You don't have to worry about the seat. And another change was made was that the clear floor space was 36, as shown in here, 36 by 60. Now it's 30 by 60. Slide 59. This is just to show with all of the red arrows that if you have no seat provided, which is one of the things I just mentioned, your controls are permitted. Your shower head and your controls are permitted to be located on any wall. It's only important where they're provided if there's a seat, and someone would have to actually access these controls while seated on a seat. Slide 60. Again, with this, we're looking at the grab bar placement. I wanted to ensure that you know that if you're doing the seat, because we say grab bars on three walls. If there's a seat, we're not looking for the grab bars on three walls. We don't want a grab bar behind the seat, and that grab bar should end where that seat begins. And if you're doing this rolling shower, the seat must be a folding seat in a rolling shower. And again, this would be a change with the clear floor space, where now we would be looking at 30 by 60 versus the 36 by 60. Slide 61. The shower heads and controls, as I said, it's important when you have the seat in that shower as to the placement, and from that seat wall, the controls should be placed a maximum of 27 inches on the back wall. Slide 62. Now we're looking at your classrooms. And when we look at classrooms, we know because they are common use spaces that they are required to be accessible. So therefore, they're required to be on an accessible route, required to have at least one door that's accessible getting there. All accessible rooms and spaces are required to have turning space. And there would be a requirement for wheelchair space within your classroom. Slide 63. As I said, when we looked at the scoping, that when you're dealing with classrooms, they are classified as assembly areas. Mentioned in the definition, classroom, lecture hall. But remember, when you're dealing with your bigger universities and schools, we're not just talking about classrooms when we're talking about assembly areas. We're also talking about your auditoriums, your stadiums. And you would have to look at your scoping to say how many seats are required to be accessible. Again, we're looking at your fixed seat rates. And what we've done, we did lower the scoping. Where in the 91, it was one space for every 150, excuse me, it was 1%. It's now one for every 150 and five, up to five, between 501 and 5,000. If you're over 5,000, then it's 5%. Now, this does include if you have luxury boxes, club boxes, you would look at those individually as to how many seats they have, and you would look at, there's a chart. Before you get to that 501, there is a chart within the standards to tell you based on how many seats, how many wheelchair spaces you are supposed to have. If this were a team player seating area for, say, your baseball team at your college or basketball team, then at least you're required to have at least one wheelchair space. Slide 64. Another thing that we've added to the new guidelines, we've always said they needed to be dispersed. Now we give more specifics about how they are to be dispersed. We look at, first of all, horizontal dispersion, which is your side to side. We do have an exception if they're less than 300 seats to say that they do not have to be horizontally dispersed. Two wheelchairs can be placed side by side, but if you do that, each wheelchair space still is required to have its own companion seat. And also with that 300, if it's less than 300, I should go to say, if it's less than 300 and your wheelchair spaces are in the second and the third quartile there, the middle, because it's believed that the middle is going to give you better viewing, then you're not required to further horizontally disperse. Slide 65. We also now have a requirement for vertical dispersion. And when we're looking at that, we're looking front to back. It should be, we are looking for it to provide a choice and to get average angles. We want it to be, the viewing angles to be better, equivalent or greater than those for the general public. Now, we do have an exception if you're dealing with bleachers to your vertical access, because, and we say that wheelchair spaces are only required to be provided in rows at the point of entry to bleacher seating. Slide 66. We also look at with this what type of event you're at and when you're deciding where your accessible seating should be. And if you're at an event, say you're at a theater, you're looking at a play where people are for the most part expected to be in their seats, then we're saying when you design, you should be designing so that the wheelchair space is provided so that you have a comparable sight, lines of sight over seated people. 67. On the other hand, is if you're at a sporting event where people are going to be jumping up and cheering and so forth, then you would want your lines of sight over your standing spectators. 68. When you look at, we're now to your locker rooms. And for your locker rooms, again, it's an accessible space, so you're required to have that turning space, your doors to be accessible. We have bench requirements for your locker rooms and your coat hooks and your shelf technical requirements. It's important to tell you when we talk about benches, the bench requirements only pertain to your locker rooms and your dressing and fitting rooms. They're not your benches. So when you walk outside of your building and they now have a bench sitting out in front of the building for you to just sit and smoke your cigarette, those benches are not required to comply with these requirements. These are for the benches that are actually scoped within the document. And the only scoping that you're going to find within the document are for your locker and dressing and fitting rooms. Slide 69. We get more specific with the size of your bench now. In 91, basically, we did say 24 by 48. We now give you, it should be 20 by 24 deep. We give you how long. For the first time, we're specific about it having back support. Slide 70. School office. When we look at a school office, this is an area that's going to be a work area. Of course, we have employees, your school secretary, so forth, that it's their work area. It's a public space. Your parents are coming in, dropping the kids off, picking the kids up, and it's a common use space. And we should have access to all of those elements, but here we're going to be looking at the counter. Slide 71. When we look at your sales counter, basically what we're looking at is the full depth. What you will find is that we removed, in the 91 standard, there was this whole discussion about whether there was a cash register on it or whether you and you, giving you alternate counters where you can have a desk beside it, you can have a pullout. All of that's been removed. Now we're looking at that counter to be accessible, and that would be the full depth. There would be a portion that would be the full depth of that counter, and we're allowing either a parallel or a forward approach, but know that if there is a forward approach, you do have to adhere to the knee and toe clearances that are specified in the document. Slide 72. Cafeterias, another common use space. When we're looking at cafeterias, we have accessible requirements for your tray slide. If you have your self-service where you get your condiments, your silverware, all of these need to be within the reach range. And we have accessible, you're required to have a certain number of accessible, as a matter of fact, 5% of your actual checkout. Well, I take it back. We have a chart in there that tells you how many of your checkout counters are required to be accessible. Slide 73. We're looking at, and with the cafeteria, again, all of, it's an assembly area. All of our requirements are tied to fixed, but again, we're talking about access to your programs and services. You provide this, it's a program or a service that's being provided. Therefore, ensure with your tables that you have your appropriate knee and toe clearance beneath the tables. Slide 74, libraries. Another common use space, there are specifications. Again, you would have an information counter, so you would have to have a section of that counter that's fully accessible, as well as you have requirements for specifications for in between the stacks and the actual distance in between the stacks in your library. Slide 75. We've already talked about the scoping for your ground level accessible pieces of equipment, and you need an accessible route leading to each one of them. And when we look at the accessible route for, well, not each one, one of each type, and for those that are required to be accessible, when we're looking at your accessible route leading to them, your technical specifications will be talking to you about the surface of that route, the clear width of the route, if there are any reductions to that clear width, how much that can be, your changes in level, your running slope, your cross slope, any openings, and any protruding objects along that accessible route. Slide 76. Elevated. We've already talked about how many elevated. We talked about that you had to have two different routes. 50. Well, you could have either. If the smaller one, you can have either your ramps or your transfer systems. If you're the larger, some of it must be ramp, and the rest can be either ramp or transfer system. We, in the technical specifications, we actually give you technical provisions for what that ramp should be, the slope of that ramp, the width of that ramp, whether handrails are required, as well as giving you technical requirements for the transfer system and the size of the actual steps and so forth for that transfer system. Slide 77. Area of sports activity. We look at your court sports. I've already said that when your area of sports activity, we don't change the actual surface, but you are required to have an accessible route that's going to get you directly to both sides of the court if you have a court sport as your area of sport activity. Slide 78. Swimming pools, we've already talked about the two means, and this is just to let you know that in those two means, based on the size, we do have technical specifications for that lift, for that sloped entry, for pool walls, for transfer wall, all of those things. We do have technical specifications to tell you how they should be done to say that they are accessible. Slide 79. Communications. When we look at communications, we have TTYs and telephones. We've already talked about the fact that we may not find too many telephones, but we tell you how many TTYs are required for telephones. We, in our communication section, we talk about visual alarms. We talk about signs. We talk about, here we talk about patient and visitors, but let's add students here too. As you can see, we kind of recycle sometimes. But you still may have patient if you're dealing with a hospital situation that's affiliated with a university, but also it'd be a student thrown in there with student information center or anything like that also. All of that's looked at in our communication. Slide 80. Two-way communication. With all of the safety issues these days, we find a lot of schools now have the two-way communication at the entrance where you have to buzz in, say who you are, and they let you in. When you are dealing with a system like this, it needs to have both visual and audible signals. 81. As I said with the TTY, we've already told you how many phones need to be accessible. Another new thing in the 2010 standard, we're now saying that all public telephones are to have volume control. We talk about based on how many banks you have, they tell you how many TTYs you're required to have. There is an exception that if you have multiple banks that are located within 200 feet on the same floor, that you're not required to have a TTY at each one of those banks. 82. Visual alarms, one of the biggest things that people miss on visual alarms, they are required in all common use spaces. So toilet room is considered. Toilet room and bathing room are common use spaces. So your visual alarm appliances are required in your bathing and toilet facilities as well as all other public and common use spaces. Slide 83. Signs. When we talk about your signs, we have signs designating your permanent room and space, and those are to be have tactile requirements, your braille, your raised lettering. If you have informational signs just telling you where you need to go within a facility or building, those are going to be required to have visual requirements. Then we have signs like your directories, your menus, your occupant's name. It may be Mr. Smith's office today and Mr. Brown's office tomorrow. These things are change, so we consider them temporary and they are exempt from the signage requirements. 84. This is just to show you some of the signs I described, the exempt ones. It's showing you there, your building directory, doctor's office, your college, where your professors are, any of that could change at any time. Your accessible entrance, your directional signage, that's showing you where to go to the accessible. Now remember, that has to have your visual requirements. Then you have your room designation. Most likely, if it's your bathroom today, it's still going to be a bathroom tomorrow. We consider that pretty permanent. Those are the ones that are required to have your tactile requirements. 85. Okay, classroom acoustics. So the board has been working for several years on classroom acoustics to look at the effects that the classroom acoustics could have on a student's actual learning and hearing, especially students that have hearing impairments. Two reports are already in place, guidelines. ANSI has two guidelines. One, part one of that guideline looks at permanent school acoustics, and the other looks at relocatable classroom acoustics. And the board is looking to adopt this standard in the future. Slide 86. Now I think we are ready. I hope I didn't lose too many of you or go too fast at any point, but now we're ready to try to address some of your questions.
Okay, we're going to give Arlene a chance to catch her breath a bit here, and I have been monitoring some of the questions that have been coming through, and it appears a lot of the questions that were coming in came in before Arlene addressed some of the topics. So I think for many of the questions that were asked, you should have answers to many of those questions because she did go into a lot of the details that you raised here. I wanted to bring up a few that have come in more recently. One question is, is access required to and inside the dugout space at a baseball field? And Erling mentioned kind of briefly that there is a requirement to connect to team player seating areas through an accessible route, and that is where there is fixed seats in a team player seating area, you would have that requirement. So, yes, that requirement for an accessible route to a recessed or to a dugout space may be required. Again, if it has fixed, there is a exception to allow for use of a platform lift in that case that is specific to providing access to areas of sport activity and team player areas. So that is an option. Again, you know, Erling's been talking about the requirements for new construction and alteration. So you have to keep in mind that you may have very many existing conditions that don't meet these provisions, and you need to be, as Erling mentioned, looking at your existing facility with respect to barrier removal, readily achievable barrier removal if it's a Title III entity, or achieving program access for a Title II entity. So that's what the guidance is for existing facilities and would come into play if you were looking at providing access to a dugout in an existing facility. For questions related to existing facilities and what you are required to do, we must encourage you to call the Department of Justice. That's not part of our authority. We deal with new construction and alteration. Their number is 800-514-0301. I'll say that again. It's 800-514-0301. Again, for more guidance about what to do with existing facilities. There's also some questions related to the Erling touched on this requirement, or there was actually a question that came in about sinks and about laundry sinks, and the question was basically, I guess, asking for some more guidance there. You know, how can you make a special sink accessible when the purpose of it needs to be deep and therefore no knee space is available? And I think what she was pointing out is that there is an exception for mop and service sinks. Okay, so that is exempt. But she was pointing out if you did have a sink, if it was a mop or a service sink, you would have that exception, and that exception would not require knee clearance, obviously, or knee space. But if you had a sink that was in a classroom where you were providing instruction to students, that sink would be required to be accessible and therefore would require knee clearance. So hopefully that clarifies it a bit. Another couple questions came in about locker rooms and what exactly is required. And, you know, basically the general requirements is that 5% of the locker rooms are required to be accessible. And then within the lockers, or within the locker rooms, the lockers themselves, 5% of each type are required to be accessible. So a type could be a full-size locker compared to a half-size locker. And with that comes a requirement for an accessible bench, which there are technical provisions that specify what that needs to look like. So the accessible locker would also be required to have a clear space in front of it, and anything that was any kind of hook that was or mechanism that was inside of the accessible locker would have to be within the reach range, a maximum of 48 inches. And of course, then any operating mechanism would also have to comply with the controls and operating mechanisms requirement in 309. So that would be the basic overview of what is required in terms of accessible lockers. Looking at some further ones that have come in now.
I did say 5%.
It should have been 0.5. Yeah. Do you want to? I think Erlene.
Okay. Yeah, I did want to address, I did make a mistake there because I did say, we had a question come in where someone was saying, because when I talked about assembly areas and the scoping for over 5,000 and I said 5%, and that is not what the requirement says. It does say a half a percent. It's 0.5%, not 5%. So I just wanted to clarify that was my mistake. Sorry about that. Then there was another question where someone talked about the two-way communication, and where we talked about that people are buzzing and then they have to get in, and the question said basically that by the time, it asked did there address, was there something to address the distance between where that two-way communication is and actually accessing the door, because it said that by the time they actually get to the door, it has relocked. And right now there is not a requirement as far as technical requirement. That would be something that I would say would probably need to be addressed in their policies and procedures, and maybe because there can be, I'm sure there can be something that can be timed there, but it's not something that's actually addressed in the ADA standards at this point in time.
Here's another one related to bus loading zones, and the question is a school bus parking must have a passenger loading zone? And that's not required. In fact, the majority of requirements in the ADA accessibility standards don't require elements to be provided. Rather, it's when you decide that you're providing it. So no, you're not required to have a passenger loading zone, but if you do provide one, you do have to comply with the provisions. So there's another question about swimming pool requirements for 300 linear feet if it's one side aggregate length of wall, or it's the entire pool wall. It's the linear feet of the pool wall. So that's how you would determine. Even if part of the pool wall is not an area, maybe there's some landscaping where you don't have direct access into the water, that's still part of the actual pool wall. You would count that in determining your means of accessibility with respect to the 300 linear feet. Okay, probably have question time for one more. Arlene, you see one? And while she's looking here, let me just remind you that if you have additional questions on something that we said in this webinar or any other questions on the accessibility standards, please feel free to contact our hotline. We are available on Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday from 10 to 5:30 Eastern Time. And that number is 800-872-2253. Again, that's 800-872-2253. And
okay, and we have one other question I was going to address. Someone asked, if you have a utility area that's not required to be ADA compliant, but if there's a sign that's required to be put there by the fire department, if that sign needs to meet the requirement, the ADA requirements, then yes. The ADA never requires that a sign be there, but once a sign is placed there for whatever reason, then that sign does need to meet the ADA requirements. And I believe, Peg, did you give just wanted to say, I realize I talked a lot and I took a lot of the time, and so a lot of your questions may not have been addressed, but you can actually email us at ta@access-board.gov, and I am the person that does man that box, so in all likelihood you will be hearing back from me for an answer to your question, of course, unless you never want to hear my voice again. But thank you all again for joining us today.
All right, and at this point, we'll turn it over to Claudia.
All right. Thank you, Arlene and Peggy. This is a lot of information. It was good information. You can see by the overwhelming response and questions, it was a lot of detail to take in. Just want to remind everyone, we have our next session on accessible golf courses. That will be January 5th. If you have not registered, I encourage you to visit www.accessibilityonline.org to register for that session. It's open, and we'll be keeping that registration open until the day before of the event. So please go ahead and do so with ample time. I just want to remind everyone that this session was recorded, and we will post the archive 3 business days from today. Along with the recording, we will post a copy of this presentation for you to download and access at your leisure later on. So thank you, everyone. Thank you, Peggy, Arlene. This is a great session. Hope everyone has a great holiday, and this session has ended. To exit, please click the X in the upper right-hand corner. Thank you, and have a good day.